This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Here we go, Tuesday, December 10th, another rainy day. Today in the New Orleans area, 90% chance for showers. They said that neutral ground parking was allowed until 8 this morning, and I've not seen anything to extend it. Have you seen, Tim Zimmer, seen anything to extend it? I didn't get a text from Nola Reddy or anything like that, so maybe they'll extend it. But as the last I heard, you were supposed to move your car by 8 a.m. this morning, but yet still a chance for showers, so we'll see what they decide. Huh? Still 8 a.m. this morning, right? Neutral ground parking, that's what I thought. But yet still more heavy rain forecast for today, so we'll see what they do about that. Then, as you matriculate through the week, that clears up. Highs today of 74. Chance for showers lingers tomorrow. Nowhere near as much, though. And then highs tomorrow of only 58, 56 on Thursday. 63 on Friday for that Shaw State Championship game in the Dome. Noon on Friday. Tim Zimmer, I may have to break out the Letterman jack from the Letterman jacket from the class of and wear it. Justin Buechler joins us now, associate professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University, to talk about President-elect Trump's first interview. How you doing, Justin?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Takeaways from the first interview, as I understand it, that former President—I'm just going to call him President Trump—gave to Kristen Welker.
It's interesting that he gave one. I think right now the interesting thing from my perspective is we're sort of focused on the nominations for cabinet positions and some of the controversies like Robert F. Kennedy. So what's he going to have Robert F. Kennedy do? It's interesting that he actually gave the interview. It was a Trump interview. What are we going to say?
Tell me why you say it's interesting. And I would like you to, because I don't remember, Professor, with sports and Saints and LSU and so many things that I got that come across this desk. When it comes to President Trump's first term and the period between his election and inauguration, and traditional presidents and the period between their election and inauguration, is this any different? Tell me what's going on here.
So what's going on right now is during this period, the president-elect will start naming the people who will head the executive agencies and start negotiating with the Senate to make sure that the nominees will get confirmed. We've already had one person withdraw from consideration. That was Matt Gaetz as the nominee for attorney general. So in some ways it's relatively normal, but in some ways it's not, because not all of the nominees are conventional picks. We have some back and forth over some of the more controversial picks who remain, like Pete Hegseth and Tulsi Gabbard. We then have questions over exactly what the Department of Government Efficiency is going to do with Elon Musk. So there's a little bit more of an unusual aspect to a transition back to former President Trump, soon to be president again. But in some ways, it's relatively normal.
One thing that I'm wondering about is, and I don't mean this in any way disrespectfully to President Trump, he never has really seemed to me to be an ideologue. He has been a person that is personality driven, and he does seem to like a lot of attention toward himself. But I don't know that he necessarily has really expressed or strong. He seems more pragmatic than ideologic. Does that make sense to you, or is that just my imagination?
So I think the way that I would put it is slightly different. He has a very constrained set of positions that he holds sincerely. If you look at his record throughout his life, he has flip-flopped on a lot of issues. He's flip-flopped on, obviously, abortion. He's flip-flopped
Let me jump in for a second. Let me go right there. To me, for abortion, and I look at what he said here about he has no intention of making a day after abortion pill or he said he will not seek to impose restrictions on abortion pills. I don't know that he really has a strong opinion on abortion.
No,
what do you think?
Yeah, I think personally that's right. I think personally he doesn't have an opinion on abortion. If you go back much earlier in his life, he was probably somewhat more pro-choice. He then had to adopt a more pro-life position in order to run as a Republican. If you go back earlier in his life, he had taken a position of a more government intervention in healthcare. Then he ran as a Republican, so he had to oppose more government intervention in healthcare. But I think there are two positions that have been absolutely consistent throughout his life, which demonstrate a more sincere belief. One is he does believe in tariffs. He truly believes in tariffs.
Agreed.
He has always supported tariffs. The other is that he sincerely believes in restrictions on immigration.
Yes.
So those are the positions that he has held sincerely throughout his life. He has not flip-flopped on those at all. So I think the proper way to understand his positions is to say that he only really holds a very limited set of beliefs. On anything else, he will take whatever position is most convenient politically at the time.
And that,
but on tariffs and immigration, he really does hold sincere beliefs.
That summarized it perfectly, because that's what I was dancing around and couldn't quite get out of my mouth. When it comes to social issues, I don't think he really cares. I think he drifts to the hard right because that's where the votes are. That's what it took to get elected. I do know that and firmly believe that when it comes to immigrations and tariffs, he does have beliefs. He is ideological when it comes to that. Those things resonate with him. And I just wonder when it comes to the fact that he will have no more elections. This is the last election he'll ever have. I just wonder about where this administration goes. And, of course, the cabinet choices that he's made have raised some eyebrows. But I just wonder if this administration is going to be more focused on tariffs with an eye toward the economy of the nation and immigration and the rest of the social issues about which some people are very concerned. I don't know if that will be as much of a concern or should be as much of a concern to them. But if you look at the cabinet nominations, I'm just wondering who he has to appeal to now, because we'll pick it up when we come back here. I'm trying to figure out, does he focus his administration on immigration and tariffs and then let the rest of it slide, or does he have to bargain on social issues with the far right in order to get his tariff and immigration policy imposed? Or, I'll throw one more in there, is he still the 1,000-pound gorilla in the room where the Senate and the House focus on what he tells them to focus on? So I think I've laid it out. We'll talk about it when we come back with Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University, talking about President Trump and his plans for his first couple of months in office. Back in a flash, traffic now, WWL. 6:25 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Looking at this text line, it amazes me. I get texts from two different numbers from people, and we're talking to Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. And I don't mean to laugh at him, Professor, but they are so incensed and butthurt about me criticizing President Trump. I didn't say a word about President Trump, so apparently, with some Trump supporters, unless you genuflect and bring Frank golden sense, what is it, gold, frankincense, and myrrh to the crib, then apparently you're against him. And I didn't say a negative word about him at all. I'm just talking about what his administration would look like. But that being said, there are people that truly worship this man.
He has some very loyal fans. I think that's a good way to put it. Yeah. Yeah.
So let's talk about January 6th. Pardons. He mentioned that the people that stormed the White House on January 6th, he would pardon. He also mentioned that maybe when it comes to the people on the committee, the January 6th committee, that current President Biden should pardon them. Thoughts on all of that, and how likely is that to be a priority for him, and could that derail whatever he attempts to do with his administration? And the two main issues, I think, as we agreed, would be immigration and tariffs.
Yeah. I think it is highly likely that he issues a lot of pardons for those prosecuted for January 6th. That's just highly likely. He has made that promise. It has been a political issue. It has been a galvanizing political issue for those on the right. So I think that it is highly likely that those pardons come. There was at least one person who was in some sort of trial. I don't remember the exact context, but he seemed to be rather blasé about the process, asserting that he was about to be pardoned anyway. So I think those pardons are highly likely. I don't see what the political consequences would be for Trump's political agenda. There will be obviously political backlash about it because January 6th is obviously pretty politically contentious for very obvious reasons. But those pardons are going to happen. Whether or not there will be more pardons from outgoing President Biden, that does tend to happen. I think we've already seen the most controversial Biden pardon. I don't see how it would get more controversial than that one. But it is somewhat traditional for an outgoing president to issue some controversial pardons on the last day or so, and that may happen. Regarding prosecutions of those involved in investigating January 6th, I don't see that happening. That seemed to be kind of an empty threat. I see no way that that could actually happen. One of the things that we do know about Donald Trump is that he makes a lot of noise and a lot of his threats are kind of empty. Unfortunately, some of them are not empty, and that's where you get into some problems. But I think the threat to prosecute people involved in investigating January 6th, those are probably empty threats.
I guess my question, Professor, before we run out of time, is who's driving the wagon now? Is President Trump driving the wagon and dictating what the Senate and the House look at in terms of, because he wants, he's hell-bent on immigration, and I'm not saying it's wrong, on immigration and tariffs, or does he continue to have to cater to the far right on some issues, and that's why I brought it up earlier, that he's not particularly concerned with, but made it seem as though he was, just like every politician, because you got to get votes?
Yeah, the quick answer is for immigration and tariffs, he can do a lot of that through executive action completely independently of the House and the Senate, and that's what he'll probably do. And the House and the Senate are going to pass a budget reconciliation bill, which will be a package of tax cuts, and that'll be that.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time. As always, 6:30, we'll talk to Rafael Goyeneche when we come back about the second line shooting, Jefferson Parish guns, crime in the metropolitan area, and more. Right now, time for WWL First News. All right, 6:44, 16 till 7. Rain again today, then it cools off tomorrow. Highs in the 50s tomorrow. And Thursday, and then not quite as cool on Friday. Highs then, as it stands now, about 63 degrees. So, Rafael Goyeneche joins us now, President of Metropolitan Crime Commission, to talk about this second-line shooting and how it spans both banks of the river. How you doing, Rafael?
I'm fine, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Thanks for getting up and taking the time with us. Let's talk about this whole thing that's going on with... Yeah, two brothers that have different names that were involved in, I'll just let you tell a story because you'll probably be better versed to do it than am I, but it was a drive-by in West Wego, then a shooting in at the second line, and it involved a beef that goes back. Tell me about it.
Well, right. So, I mean, you know, the highlights of it are that during the second line in mid-November on Almonaster Street. There was video of some people engaged in an argument. It resulted in a double homicide. And the other day, the police arrested Curtis Gray as one of the shooters in that incident. So apparently Curtis Gray, as a juvenile in Jefferson Parish, had been arrested and prosecuted for an attempt murder there. Gray and another individual were involved in an attempted murder in Jefferson Parish. The shooter was not Gray, was another young man. He ended up pleading guilty and getting 7 years. Curtis Gray, in that particular case, because he was a juvenile, his case was transferred to adult court in Jefferson Parish, and he ended up pleading to a probated sentence for aggravated battery. And the reason that the district attorney's office in Jefferson granted that deal was because A, he wasn't the shooter. B, the victim, who was a 16-year-old, moved out of state, and his mother refused to return to Louisiana for the prosecution. And the mother was okay with the non-shooter, Gray, getting a probated sentence. So basically, he was on probation when he committed that double homicide. And, so now... he is potentially facing life in prison if he's convicted of these murders. So this is another example of, you know, how you can have a violent offender, a youthful violent offender. And because of the circumstances, he avoided prison. And now he's facing potentially a life sentence, and two people have lost their lives as a result of that.
So just like with Orleans Parish, is there anything Jefferson Parish could have done anything differently to keep this guy from either getting a gun or getting back on the street?
Well, no. I mean, as far as getting the gun, you know, there are apparently now his mother has been arrested. So the gun in this particular instance, the shooting, the murder weapon, was linked to another arrest in Jefferson Parish involving another family member of the mother. I'm not exactly sure what the relationship was, but there was a young man arrested for possessing a firearm as a juvenile at a parade route. And what ended up happening is that the weapon was returned to the mother by the judge in this particular case. And then that weapon, when it was confiscated by the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office, did a ballistics profile on it. And the casings from that weapon from the arrest in 2023 for a parade route, possessing a firearm at a parade route, were the same ballistics for the murder weapon that was used on Almonaster Street last month. So that weapon was put back into commerce, and apparently Gray obtained it. And returning a weapon to a family that apparently wasn't able to make sure that children weren't having access to it was, I think, poor judgment in this particular case. But, you know, that's hindsight. I don't see, as far as the deal that was offered Gray, you have to have a cooperating victim. And if the victim, who was 16 years old, left state, and his mother was not coming back to Louisiana, it limited the district attorney's office, and they decided to take the best potential outcome. They got the shooter. He got 7 years, and Gray ended up getting probation. It was on probation at the time that he committed this double homicide.
Now, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. One thing I think I do want to talk about is the metropolitan aspect of this, where it's not just an Orleans Parish thing. It's not just a Jefferson Parish thing. I think there was some cooperation here, which led to the arrest, which is a positive thing. And the other thing, Raphael, and look, I'm a gun guy. I own guns, several guns. I have a concealed carry permit. I'm not anti-gun. But one thing that all of these crimes have in common is that gun, right? So I don't know how you, in the future you go about preventing any of this, or is it just the society that we live in, or I don't know how the mother can be prosecuted unless they can prove that she gave the gun to the kid. We'll talk about all that when we come back. 651, 9 till 7, traffic now, WWL. All right, 6:54, 6 till 7. Rafael Goyeneche, our friend, our guest, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. So the arrest made in the second-line shooting that goes back to an ongoing dispute between rival groups in Marrero and West Wego, and that goes to, I guess, the Metropolitan Crime Commission, Rafael, which is not just about Orleans Parish. And talk right. about, I guess, the interagency cooperation that happened here to affect an arrest.
Right. So, you know, it's law enforcement recognizes that the offenders really don't pay attention to jurisdictional boundary lines. So they know that offenders that reside in one parish often commit crimes in adjoining parishes. So there is a longstanding, you know, history of cooperation between law enforcement. And this case is a perfect example of the coordination and cooperation and communication that exists on a daily basis with the law enforcement agencies from this area. So the JPSO, the NOPD, the Louisiana State Police, you know, the Jefferson Parish District Attorney's Office, the Orleans Parish District Attorney's Office, they're all working together. And if they have information and if they have evidence that is helpful in solving a crime in one parish, it's going to make the entire area, including the suburban parishes, safer. So that this is not the exception. This is the norm. This happens every day in law enforcement and has been the case for years with law enforcement recognizing that if they can work together to solve a crime, everybody benefits from that.
And in this case, I know the usual route is the people talk about Orleans Parish crimes spilling over into Jefferson Parish, but in this case, it was just the opposite. Kind of?
Well, right. I mean, again, we don't know all of the tentacles in all of this, mm-hmm. but if people that reside in Jefferson Parish are coming to New Orleans to commit a crime and vice versa, that's the reason why law enforcement really recognizes that it's just good business to cooperate with your partners. And the offenders that are committing these crimes, they are just looking for opportunities. And sometimes it'll be in Jefferson Parish. Sometimes it'll be in New Orleans. And look, law enforcement recognizes that.
Let's go to the judge. And I talked about the gun thing before. This gun is, you know, in all shootings, a gun is probably one of the common things that are involved, or else there would not be a shooting. But this specific gun, I don't know, did the mother, we don't know all the facts or anything, but at what point are you responsible for your own gun if your family member takes it one time or another family takes it again? I don't know how you control all of that. Thoughts?
Well,
did the judge do anything wrong as far as you know?
As far as I know, but I haven't done a deep dive on it yet. Mm-hmm. I found out about it yesterday. So, basically, the gun was evidence. And after the completion of the case, the owner, which was apparently the mother, requested her weapon back. The judge agreed to sign it back to her. To get it, she had to go to the JPSO and prove ownership and present the court document. And the judge ordered it returned to her, and that's what happened. And ultimately, that weapon resurfaced again in the double homicide last month.
So at what point legally, and I know you're an attorney, Are you responsible for the weapon if you don't report it stolen? General, not in this case, but generally speaking, where does your criminal liability extend if you own a weapon and it is used in a crime or more than one?
So, you know, if you are part and parcel of the plan to commit the crime, of course, you're a principal to it. But in this particular case, unless law enforcement has other information, that could very well be the case. Mm-hmm. You know, and oftentimes when arrests are made, the police get warrants to get people's cell phones, records. So sometimes people text their plans back and forth. And that's a common way that law enforcement solves cases and prosecutors use to prove guilty knowledge and intent. So I don't know all of the evidence that's available, but unless they have something compelling like that, it's very unlikely that the mother's going to be charged with a crime in connection with the fact that that firearm was used in a double homicide.
Thank you, Rafi. Appreciate your time. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year if we don't talk to you again, but I got an idea we may. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You bet. We'll talk to Greg Upton. We come back, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies, about Louisiana seeing billions of dollars in investments in the energy industry transition.